Xfinity Mobile is a new kind of network designed to save you money while streaming your favorite music. Like that 90s jams playlist you've played 72 times today. It combines America's largest, most reliable 4G LTE with the most Wi-Fi hotspots. Get up to 5 lines of unlimited nationwide talk and text included with your Xfinity internet at no extra cost. All you pay for is data. Visit an Xfinity store or click now to see how much you can save with Xfinity Mobile. Restrictions apply. Requires Xfinity internet service. Equipment, taxes, fees, and other charges extra. Limited to 2 lines pending internet activation.
Hello, thank you for joining us on Three Women, Three Ways. We are the show that tackles tough topics. Sometimes we also tackle unusual topics. And one of those unusual topics, at least unusual for me, is humiliation. I just had this epiphany when I was doing a little reading, and I found a study that was all about humiliation, and it was in APA PsychNet, and it's called Toward a Globally Informed Psychology of Humiliation. What on earth is humiliation? We kind of know, but what's that has to do with anything? And I wanted to find out more. So I contacted Linda M. Hartling and Evelyn Linder, and they are authors of the study. And Evelyn has, she's educated up the wazoo. She has a dual education as a medical doctor and a psychologist. She's the founding president of Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies and co-founder of the World Dignity University Initiative. She's also a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015, 2016, and 2017. So we're honored to have you, Evelyn.
Thank you. It's me who is honored.
Great. Oh, and yet I've been nominated for nothing, so go figure. Okay. Linda Hartling is director of the Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies and co-founder of the World Dignity University Initiative and Dignity Press. She has a doctorate degree in clinical psychology and is past associate director of Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women at Wellesley College. So thank you for joining us, Linda.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. So tell me, what does humiliation have to do with anything?
Oh, big question. It's interesting because when you say that, I'm going, well, our group has come to the conclusion that it has to do with a lot of things, and it's pretty amazing to what extent it is pervasive in our society. I guess I should say that Evelyn and I have been working together with a global community of individuals who are looking at the dynamics of humiliation on multiple levels. You can think of humiliation as an internal experience, those feelings of unworthiness, shame, depression, or you can think of it as an external interactions, bullying, aggression, domestic violence, racism, sexism, or you can think of it as systemic conditions, intractable poverty or forced migration, displacement. So there are so many levels that our community has been looking at to study this experience of humiliation. And that's what led to the article that you saw, The Globally Informed Psychology of Humiliation, is we were just reflecting on this global community that is out in the world looking at how we can reverse cycles of humiliation and promote equal dignity around the world.
Wow. Great answer, and makes me have a million questions. Evelyn, how did you get involved in an interest and in obviously a huge interest in humiliation studies?
Well, about over 20 years ago, in the 90s, well, actually, I came from a background in working in the public schools and education, and then I moved into prevention and substance abuse, and then into foster care support. And I became very interested in how relationships promote or obstruct our ability to engage in healthy behavior. And that led me to this concept of humiliation as being a force in people's lives that keeps us from participating in healthy relationships. We feel ashamed of ourselves. We withdraw. We do engage in strategies to survive those experiences where we feel put down, degraded, demeaned, devalued.
So I aren't you kind of wait a minute? Aren't you kind of victim blaming with that when you say that we come up with ways to continue in those relationships? I mean, don't we think that, oh gosh, if somebody is in a bad relationship, they just pick up their boots and they leave, right?
Yes. Well, I think when I'm looking at relationships, I'm not only looking at how humiliation impacts those relationships, I'm also looking at what are the qualities of relationships that help us survive those kinds of situations. What are the qualities of relationships that help us to be resilient when we're faced with those kinds of challenges? It's by developing a scale to assess the internal experience of humiliation. And what stood out in that research was that people will accumulate feelings of humiliation from various experiences throughout their lives. And also they feel a sense of fear of humiliation going forward as a result of that accumulation. And these experiences tend to stick to us almost like glue in our lives. However,
yeah, but you know, those negative traumatic things stick to us so much more than the positive things. Isn't that just kind of human nature?
I think so. I think that's the way, you know, humanity has survived. So that also led me into working with the Wellesley Centers for Women, or the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute in particular, to look at what are the qualities of relationships that give us resilience. And I was introduced to the relational cultural theory that emphasizes that growth-fostering relationships are a central human necessity throughout people's lives, and that helps us stay strong in the face of these kinds of experiences where we have been degraded or demeaned or devalued or live in inner conditions where that make us feel degraded or demeaned and valued. So part of our work with the Humiliation Studies Network is not only how to undo experiences of or transform experiences of feeling humiliated and degraded, it's also about building relational resilience and skills to overcome and transcend these kinds of experiences. But I developed the scale, and then at the same time, Evelyn is working around the world looking at the connection between humiliation and violent conflict. So maybe Evelyn could talk about that side of our initial start
that
of this work.
Great. Thank you for doing my job there. That's great. So, Evelyn, can you tell us, you know, about this global concept? I mean, when I hear humiliation, I don't think global. I think, ooh, somebody said something that just ripped me to the core, and I'll probably carry it with me forever. So what does global humiliation mean?
You asked Linda how she got interested in humiliation studies, and allow me to tell you that Linda founded humiliation studies. Yes, she wrote her doctorate on humiliation in 1995. And I started to work on my doctoral dissertation on humiliation in 1997. And it was humiliation and war and genocide. And the case studies were in Somalia and Rwanda on the background of Nazi Germany. So I finished in 2001. So Linda is the first one ever, to my view, to my knowledge, who has written a doctoral dissertation on humiliation, and I'm number two. And we founded a new field in academia, a transdisciplinary field that goes from the micro level to the macro level. You know, the micro level is humiliation in families, and the meso level, you would say, would be in societies, in communities. And then you have the global level, and there you have dynamics of humiliation. Just now, we see that very, very recent, we see the leader of North Korea trying to out-humiliate those he sees at his adversaries. And it is humiliation that it has the core, you know, trying to be or feel respected on the background of feeling humiliated. So there you have the macro level. So it's a transdisciplinary field from that also includes all disciplines, academic disciplines, from psychology to history, anthropology, all sociology. There is almost no field that is not touched by that. So it's a transdisciplinary field that is at all levels, macro, micro, meso level, and it is also a new field, I think, because interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary work is not easy. And also, I think it is new. There's another reason for why it is new. The reason is that humiliation has become more salient in the recent years or decades.
What do you mean by that? Can you explain what you mean by becoming more salient?
Yes. When you look at... Just let me take apartheid as an example, the system of apartheid. You and me, I think we would agree that it's a system of systemic humiliation. And when it was introduced, it was called segregation, and it was viewed as a solution for problems. It was seen as something very positive. So when it was still seen as something very positive, it was also seen as pro-social to humiliate people into humility so that they would, you know, respect their due place in society. Another example would be the man who still believes that it is his duty to beat his disobedient wife and children. This man would say that humiliating his wife, beating her, is a path for her to learn to respect her place in society and to learn humility. So this is the old system, and still today many societies are just... We had our last conference in India, and there is a caste system. And the lower caste, many of them, they feel that humiliation is not a violation. It's pro-social. It teaches them humility. So we have a change in the English language in 1757 in the encyclopedia that for the first time to humiliate is no longer the same as to humble, no longer pro-social. It is for the first time anti-social. It is for the first time the violation of the dignity of an individual in 1757. So then come the human rights declarations, and the core sentence in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is every human or all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And if you look back before this turning point, then this sentence was unthinkable, like the man who is convinced that it is his duty to beat his disobedient wife, or apartheid when it was still seen as segregation and something positive. So this sentence in such systems, such hierarchical ranked systems, this sentence would be all human beings are born unequal in worthiness and rights, and some are more free than others. So there is a turning point in history, very recently in our human history, which makes humiliation more salient, because now humiliation is no longer pro-social, it is now anti-social. And if we look at Mandela, Nelson Mandela, what he did, he was born low, and he went to the white supremacists in South Africa, and he said to them, look, times have changed. No longer can you arrogate supremacy, because times have changed. Now, please, step down from arrogating supremacy. Step down, meet everybody else in the middle on the level of equality and dignity. And he went to his brothers and sisters, the black brothers and sisters in South Africa, and Mandela said to them, look, it is not nature's order that you are down. It's not God's will that you are down at the bottom of society. No, it's a violation. You have a right to get angry. You have a right to rise up. You know, so the right to get angry is given to those down by the human rights message, by the human rights call, the human rights invitation that we all deserve to have are equal in dignity. So this is a call upon everybody who is down at the bottom to get angry, basically, and to do something about it. You know, the social worker would go to the beaten wife and say, look here, you know, your husband is beating you. You are being humiliated. You have a right to get angry. You know, don't accept that. As you said in the very beginning, you know, pick up your boots, go. You know, but the wife might still be in the old framework and say, no, he loves me. I give him reason, you know, I'm not obedient enough, so he has a right to beat me. That would be her old response, or the traditional response. So now the social worker goes and makes her angry, you could say, and the husband would say to the social worker, look, here you come, you bring conflict into my family, there was peace before, and now you bring conflict and anger. So humiliation, therefore, is becoming more salient now.
Okay. All right. Okay. So I'm learning a lot right now, just in the last 15 minutes that we've been speaking, and I never thought of humiliation as anything more than a personal affront. But I'm hearing you making connections to words that have different meanings for me. You talked about humility, humble. It sounds to me like humiliation, and what you just explained is it didn't used to have the negative connotations it has now. But now it's very antisocial, and now it's very not a good thing by anybody's interpretation. And because it's not a good thing, and because it is still used at so many levels, both consciously and unconsciously, is humiliation a way to control people?
Oh, I think it absolutely is a way to control people. And in fact, it's a very insidious way to control people, because people will restrict their actions in order to avoid being targeted by humiliation. It's so powerful in affecting people's lives. So, yes, it's like threatening humiliation or humiliating other people leaves no fingerprints on the person. It's internalized. They internalize these experiences and, as a result, often change the course of their lives to avoid those experiences in the future. So it's a very powerful way of controlling people.
I'm going to share personal experience because, well, I have no boundaries. I just share everything. It's okay. When I was a child, my mom would use humiliation. I don't know, because of that whole complex daughter-mother relationship, and she had some mental health issues, et cetera. So I don't know whether she was doing it purposely or whether it just kind of came naturally to her. But she would say things like, when I was a little kid, somebody was kidnapped, and I was worried about that. And her response to me was to kind of laugh and say, you don't have to worry about being kidnapped. If anybody takes you in the middle of the night, as soon as it's daylight and they get a good look at you, they'll take you back. They'll bring you back home. That has always stuck with me. And although I'm not a beautiful woman, but I'm not an ugly woman, I'm an average-looking, reasonably attractive woman, right? Always have been. And yet I have always perceived myself as not being pretty. And sometimes I wonder, did that one thing convince me that I wasn't good-looking? Can that kind of humiliation... Well, first of all, is that strong enough to be humiliation? Is that really humiliation? And if so, is that one thing strong enough to make me feel that way for the next umpteen years? Because I'm really old. So is that what we're talking about at a personal level as humiliation, or am I just overreacting and overanalyzing?
I have to tell you, Heather, I have a story somewhat similar, which is to say, some rather cruel brothers said, the dog ran away because you were so ugly.
Oh, my God.
And that stuck with me. And I think it was primarily because I had no counter message. I didn't have a parent available who was able to correct that kind of experience, to repair my thinking. resulting from that experience. And yes, it did carry over throughout my life, which is, it seems stunning. But I think this is one of the qualities of humiliation that we've come to appreciate, that these experiences really do stick to people like super glue. And we've learned that they leave scars, and that actually what we can do is to work with those experiences to replace them with new experiences. And those new experiences are usually found in growth-fostering relationships, relationships in our lives that help us replace those past images with new images and new experiences that strengthen our sense of who we are beyond that earlier experience. So
okay,
I am absolutely convinced it carries over.
Okay, and I want to come back to that in a little while. I want to talk about what we're doing about this, what you guys have developed and decided and discovered are ways to kind of combat this and counteract this. But first, I want to ask Evelyn, on a global level, that my little story and Linda's story about our personal, you know, kind of intimate experience with humiliation, how are comparable experiences to more global experiences? I mean, we talked about how it made us feel and it stuck with us. When you're talking about the systemic humiliation, global humiliation, do we find that with entire populations? Can you correlate our personal experiences
yes.
to the global?
Like when I began to work with humiliation, I asked myself, or, you know, perhaps I start differently. When you remember the First World War and the Versailles Peace Treaties after that, they intentionally humiliated Germany. They thought it was a pro-social, a good thing to do to get Germany harmless, to stop Germany from being aggressive. So it intentionally humiliated Germany and hoped that this would avert, prevent a new war. Instead, it made a new war possible. Because what did Adolf Hitler do? He somehow used the sentiments of national humiliation. He brought them, he bundled them into a narrative, a story of national humiliation. And then he invited everybody in the German population to invest their personal feelings of humiliation into that narrative. And, for example, let's say workers in factories who, since centuries, were not treated respectfully, he told them, look, now you have a new cause, namely you are called upon to be part of this national story of respect and pride, and that we have to get this respect back from being humiliated. So they had a mission now that they did not have before. And so he used national humiliation as a kind of gathering point for the German population, and they invested their feelings into that narrative, and they went to war.
Okay. All right. So as a group, we can also react to that kind of humiliation. That makes it clearer to me what you mean on a global level. One of the things that both of you have mentioned are consequences of humiliation. We've kind of been talking about that a little bit. How does humiliation affect us? How does it affect us? Does it affect us physically as well as emotionally? Are there actual neurological differences after humiliation? Does it matter how often you're humiliated, if this is a repeated pattern or whether this is just an off now and then occurrence? Either one of you want to tackle that question?
Well, I think it's helpful to know that this is a relatively new field of study. So the research is emerging.
And there are some very interesting pieces of research that talks about the impact of, well, humiliation as a stressor that is a major predictor or predictor of major depression. And strong research that suggests that that the way people endure humiliation has an impact in their ability to participate in society. One piece of research talks about humiliation creating, when we're talking about the global level and large bodies of people, that humiliation can create an inertia effect, which is to say that people won't act, they won't feel empowered to act on behalf of themselves and other people. But the research overall is growing and continuing to evolve. And people, this is why we have this community of colleagues and scholars and researchers that are taking this work out in the world to examine very different aspects of experiences of humiliation, from looking at how humiliation affects children in schools and how people are affected by in domestic violence situations, and how people are affected by all sorts of different experiences. And that's actually what led to the paper, that we really learned in our research that we have so much more to learn about this experience. So this is kind of it's a very exciting time for us to see what is coming out, because people are beginning to recognize that humiliation has not only an effect on the individual, it has an effect on the witnesses to humiliation. Other people are impacted beyond the actual victim, and it ripples out into the community. So I guess I would say that we're really learning a lot.
You mentioned about the witnesses.
Go ahead, Evelyn. Evelyn, go ahead.
Yes, Linda, would you also like to share, you know, that humiliation is the most intense emotion, and that loss alone is not as strong as loss together with humiliation? Could you talk a moment about that?
Well, there was a wonderful study by a man named Kendler about looking at different experiences that are, as I say, major predictions of depression. And the number one experience was the loss of a relationship, but number two was an experience of humiliation. But also the combination of loss and a relationship and humiliation was more powerful than the two that we just mentioned. And you can think of the people that have been forced forced immigration, asylum seekers, they're losing their relationships, and they have to endure this humiliation of being displaced, a displaced population. So it has an powerful impact, and some of this research is continuing to grow in various different ways and in different applications.
Huh.
We actually see it as one of... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Evelyn would, and I think from her research, really illustrates that humiliation may be one of the strongest forces that creates rifts between people and breaks down relationships in society.
It's almost a betrayal if you're humiliated by a loved one. It's bad enough if you're humiliated by a stranger, but if it's a loved one that humiliates you, wow, that's almost like an intimate partner betrayal kind of thing. At least that's my two cents worth with my dad.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you are, you know, some people might simply laugh. Like if somebody, just think of a very proud male, and then a woman tries to humiliate him, he will just laugh and humiliate her back.
So humiliation is about power.
Oh, it has a lot to do with power. And I think people's reactions to humiliation vary. In one of our papers that Evelyn and I wrote for the Journal of Counseling and Development, we talked about people's response to humiliation may include internalizing the humiliation, and people will blame themselves, and which leads to, depression. Or they may externalize their humiliation by attacking back. And these are the kinds of responses that we're trying to look at. And how do you move on from there? How do you transform somebody who is externalizing? And some would say some of the school shootings that we have seen over recent years have at the root a sense of humiliation, whether the shooters were victimized by being excluded or victimized by bullying. These situations can create, as Evelyn has said, a ticking time bomb that leads people to act out with aggression. Or these situations can cause massive depression in individuals.
So we've talked a little bit about what is humiliation and the history of it and of our understanding of it, and we talked about ways that people can be humiliated. We've talked a little bit about the effects of that, but the responses to that, you just mentioned some, self-blame and either internalizing or externalizing. What are some of the other physiological responses? What are some other ways that we respond to humiliation as human beings? Evelyn?
I think you have had very, very interesting talks with other researchers on trauma just recently. And there, I think the physiological reactions are very similar, because if humiliation really has set yourself, you know, as you said, humiliation has to do with power. Humiliation, or very, very important part, is to be made helpless, to be pushed down, held down. And this is traumatic. So I remember that you had these wonderful conversations in the past weeks, I think, where you were talking with people who were doing research about the physiological correlates of trauma. And I would say that this is relevant for humiliation. It's a form of trauma.
Okay. All right. So any of the responses that we typically see and expect from trauma, a trauma experience, we can also expect from a humiliation experience. Okay. Let's talk about the consequences. Now, again, Linda, you're two steps ahead of me on my interview here, Linda. So you're very astute today. Either that or I'm very behind. I coordinate my questions with the clock, and I'm going, no, don't talk about consequences yet. Don't do that. Okay. But I want to get back to consequences. You talked about possibly depression. You talked about social inertia. Does it affect children differently than adults? Are there different responses for children, consequences for children? We also had Dr. Vincent Folletti on the show, who, of course, authored the ACEs study about adverse childhood experiences. And so ever since then, he was so articulate, and that study is so astounding to me. I keep going back to that over and over and over because, you know, I mean, clearly, here, you know, having that kind of humiliation as a young person would be one of those adverse childhood experiences of trauma that can impact a kid for the rest of their lives. So do we see this with trauma? Is there a particularly different kind of response among children who experience humiliation?
Well, I think what my key concern with children is humiliation can induce a type of isolation, which is people close down and close themselves off from the very finding the relationships they need in order to transform those experiences, to rewrite those experiences, to write a new story or new narrative about their experience of having been humiliated. Why did this happen? Who's helping them find their way to transform we'll call them relational images that had been hurtful in the past. And as adults, I think we have more resources to deal with those kinds of things, but children, I think, are particularly vulnerable. And I would say one of my key concerns is humiliation instills a type of disconnection And that can evolve to an even more troubling state, which Jean Baker Miller, the legendary psychiatrist, would say is condemned isolation, not having any capacity to engage in relationships and therefore losing hope. And so I think about children as having an increased vulnerability unless they have people in their lives, even just one person in their lives, that can help them move forward, help them build the kind of resilience they need to overcome those kinds of experiences.
Okay. All right. So we've got depression, we've got inertia, or we've got just the opposite. We've got people striking out and perhaps using. Can we learn humiliation? Is that something we can learn to add to our toolbox as a way to live our lives?
That's a curious thought, Heather. I need you to say more.
I think we have some very good example in politics just now. You can learn. If you are humiliated, if you are the recipient of humiliation, one way is to learn how to humiliate the others instead, to hit back immediately. This is a learning process.
Good.
You can do it.
Humiliate others in order to avoid humiliation, or using it as a tool?
Another tool to add to your box of how to negotiate the world. And
if you look at black pedagogy. You remember black pedagogy? Alice Miller, how she described it? Their parents, and she wrote or she argues that this is one of the sources of Nazi ideology. That parents were told that a good parent has to break the will of the child. So a good parent would beat the child. A good parent would, for example, let the child have a dog or a pet and then kill the pet in front of the child. The aim of pedagogy was to break the will of the child. So this is the traditional old, called now black pedagogy, but at some point these parents were taught to do that. They felt guilty if they spoiled the child by not doing it. So there they learned humiliation as a form of pedagogy.
When I was a child, parents didn't compliment their children. I mean, it was a rare parent who did. You just didn't get compliments. If you got an A minus, it was, why didn't you get an A? If you did something good, why didn't you do it better? And children of my children's era were praised for everything. They inhaled. They got a trophy. They were praised for everything. Oh, look at that. One of my favorite stories is when my son did the T-ball, which is the very first attempt at baseball, where they put the ball on this little stand, and then the kids knock it off with their little plastic bat, and then they run to first base. And I was a first base coach along with another father, and this kid, little kid, like we're talking 5-year-olds, came running down the first line, baseline, went to first base. He stopped about 2 feet short of the base, looked at both of us and said, "Is that first base?" And I said, yep, that's first base. And he went, "Okay." And so then he walks over and steps on it, which is what he's supposed to do, right? I mean, this was fine. But the father just went, "Yay, congratulations, you did it, yay." And I'm going, really? Do we need to be that enthusiastic because he put his foot on first base and he had to have directions to do it? I don't know. Couldn't we just said okay? So what you're talking about with humiliation is all of our thinking about child rearing seems to be cyclical. It seems that I would like to say we grow and evolve, but I'm wondering if we really grow and evolve or if we just have cycles where different qualities, different manifestations of behavior bother us more, and so then we swing the other way. That's a long, convoluted story.
Yes, Linda can talk long about the failure of the self-esteem movement.
Okay.
Yes.
Linda, go for it.
Self-esteem movement in America, which I think a number of scholars have talked about, have led to an epidemic of narcissism in our society, where we're building people up as opposed to instead of basing our value of others, the self-esteem movement sort of led, this is when I was a school teacher, actually, when we noticed in this heavy-duty encouragement of self-esteem didn't really result in people behaving or acting respectfully toward each other. So they felt really good about themselves, but their engagement with other people was not so helpful. So that's when I started questioning the self-esteem movement. And I think in terms of, and rather than self-esteem, that's why our work has looked at dignity, the sense of worth, helping people have a sense of worth that they are valued and that they mattered, versus self-esteem based on what they accomplish, whether it's being successful in sports or other things. It's a sense of worth for who they are rather than what they do. So,
jump in here? I used to teach a college. I taught at a couple of community colleges, and it occurred to me how these younger people had just overwhelming self-confidence, and not only did they possess it, but they felt that it was number one on their list of what you needed to have. You needed to be confident. And so I started right on the whiteboard, and I'd put confidence. The word confidence, and I'd say, how important is this? Oh gosh, this is very important. Oh, you have to have this. This is wonderful. Everyone in the room agreed that it is absolutely crucial that you be confident. And then I wrote the word competence, and I said, how important is this? Kinda.
That's a good example.
And I went, this, and I would circle confidence. Without this, and I would circle competence. Is just that American Idol person being voted off the thing and being outraged because she's the best singer in the world and why can't they see it? It seems like to me that confidence needs to be based on some sort of competence. But
exactly.
The idea of dignity, it doesn't matter how competent we are, every one of us deserves dignity.
Exactly.
I like that.
Exactly. It's everyone. We think of it as everyone has something to contribute, and how do we create the conditions that they can make their best contribution, and at the same time recognize that they're worthy virtue just by being who they are.
Okay. Once again, you took a step in front of me, because the next thing I wanted to talk about is. What do we do about this? And you've already mentioned counter messages, let's talk more about what do we do, first of all, about preventing people from using humiliation as a form of power, and secondly, as helping people who have been humiliated to learn, grow, and not be crippled by it.
Well, for me, since I'm a relational theorist, I think one of the keys to transforming these humiliating experiences is to truly value our relational skills, develop the relational capacities that support the equal dignity of the people around us and out in the world. And I will refer back to what kind of relationships is crucial that we need to pay attention to the quality of our relationships. It's not the number, but how are we cultivating relationships in our lives that support the dignity of all people involved? And that really goes back to my work with Jean Baker Miller, and her idea of growth-fostering relationships is a good example of what we can do in our lives to facilitate the dignity of others, because when you're in growth-fostering relationships, you'll see the outcomes of people feeling energized and empowered. They have greater clarity and knowledge, and automatically out of that grows a greater sense of worth. So my solution is, how do we establish and cultivate
those kinds of relational experiences in people's lives that will help them not only transform past experiences of humiliation, but also lead them to feel that great sense of dignity.
And I might add that I have discontinued using the term of empowerment. I remember it is in 2007 we had our conference in China, and there was a British professor in Shanghai who said, I have empowered my students for years, and what was the result? The result, they became nasty people. So he said, I no longer use the word empowerment, I use the word entrustment. And entrustment, to entrust somebody with something, to entrust people, instead of empower people. Because why? If you look at it, the term or the word empower has no end point. You can be empowered to become arrogant. And, I wrote my doctoral dissertation, among others, about the genocide in Rwanda. And you could say there it even the empowerment led to genocide, because the people who carried out the genocide, the Hutu servant, Hutu means servants, they were the ones at the bottom of society for many hundreds of years. And at some point they were empowered to want to rise up, and they did that, but they rose up too far, you could say, and they attempted to exterminate their former masters. So empowerment has no inherent end point, so therefore I don't use it anymore, and I highlight that we need to gather at the middle line. You know, if you see that as a spatial in space, you have arrogance at the top, you have humiliation at the bottom, and you have equality and dignity in the middle. This is the line of equality and dignity at which we all want to meet, or Linda and I and our group, we invite everybody to meet there. And this is the line of shared humility also. There humility comes in. Not the meek humility of a humiliated subordinate, but the confident, the entrusted humility of somebody who is at the same level as all others, namely the level of equal dignity. So therefore, it's also important to highlight the term equality in dignity rather than simply dignity, because even the term dignity can be used in a ranked way. For example, a dignitary will say, oh, look here, I'm a VIP. I'm worth more than you. So the word dignity would be used in a ranked way, in a hierarchical way. So the point is to invite all to gather in the middle, at the level of equality and dignity, where we hold hands in mutual solidarity and dignified humility.
You know,
and I think what
the notion of power fascinates me. And you're talking about your wonderful PhD dissertations, and I tried to sneak this one into my PhD dissertation, but they wouldn't buy it. Someday I'm going to write my own theory, my power theory. I believe that people have to have power. They have to. It's a human need. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's good power and there's bad power. There's power over others and there's power over yourself. And I think that the good power is power over yourself, even though, like if you're a parent with a child and your child is running for the street, you exert power over that child to keep them from running in the street. But as
right.
that child ages and matures, you teach them how to have power over themselves and within themselves, and that's the good power. That's my power theory.
Exactly.
Well,
I hope you write that dissertation.
Power over and power to. I think what the positive thing, your positive power is power to.
Power to and power with. Power with others. And I think one of the things that Evelyn's work illustrates, or what she's just talking about, how important our language is, you know, how we use language to establish power structures rather than language that facilitates equality and dignity.
Well, it seems to me that I'm clearly not an expert in humiliation, but when you're talking humiliation, you're talking like many other aspects of human life, which is you can probably humiliate people physically. You know, I mean, I'm thinking back to the days of the stocks where in the public, you know, they'd
yes.
put people, you know, in public to humiliate them. But there's also individual humiliation that we can experience. And it seems to me that when we're talking, you know, I just completely lost my train of thought. Isn't that awful? But it seems to me that when we're talking this, we've already talked about different levels of humiliation and different ways of exerting humiliation. I want to talk in the brief time that we have left, because our time has just gone crazy, about the human dignity World Dignity University Initiative. What is that?
Well, this is a project we have been working together on with the Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies community. And the focus of this project is to bring dignity to the core of learning in higher education, to provide a platform where people can contribute from all over the world, offering educational experiences that allow others to understand what it is to engage in relationships that offer equal dignity for all people involved and in many different ways. And one example might be we have been working in partnership with the University of Massachusetts looking at human dignity, human rights, and sustainable post-disaster reconstruction. And understanding the dynamics of humiliation and dignity is crucial when you are responding to major disasters and how to be helpful to people that have been traumatized by these events. So the World Dignity University is an extension of our efforts to make dignity at the core of higher education and to make this kind of knowledge and learning that grows out of our community accessible to people throughout the world. Evelyn, you might have more to add to that.
Yes, it is. You said it better than I could. It is an invitation to all educators and learners to come together and give their knowledge as a gift to the world. It is not a brick and mortar institution. It's a global, virtual initiative, and it is more an invitation. We are very unique in that we try to also already manifest how dignifying relationships need to be shaped in our economic systems. So we try to manifest a gift economy in all our work. So this World Dignity University Initiative is therefore an invitation to educators and learners to contribute with their knowledge as a gift.
Wonderful. How would I find out more about this? Is there a website or is there something that I can...
We have a website, worlddignityuniversity.org. Embryonic, it is an idea, it is an invitation, and everything is done without sponsor funding. We are very proud of a near close to zero budget. So whatever volunteers,
that's a wonderful thing to be proud of.
Yes, and so it's volunteers or you know, people who really give their time and energy and inspiration as a gift. So it grows slowly, and just now we are thinking about, you know, we need more people to develop the website so that educators, because we have many educators now who would like to contribute, and they need to be integrated into this website. And then also, you know, how when somebody completes a course, how will that course be certified, you know, what kind of certificate will that bring to the person, you know, and so they are, it is an initiative that will hopefully flower for the next 500 years.
Oh, I love that idea. WorldDignityUniversity.org. I'm going to go look that up, and I hope our listeners do too. WorldDignityUniversity.org. I think this is something that
Embryonic. You see more information because the World Dignity University Initiative is one initiative of the Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies Network, and there you find on that website you find more information. It is humiliationstudies.org. This is an older website. I am the webmaster, so whatever mistakes you see there, please inform me. It's my fault. So the humiliationstudies.org website is started in 2003, so it really encompasses all the history of our global dignity movement.
Evelyn Lindner and Linda Hartling, I've had a delightful time talking with you. I can't believe our time is almost up, but it's been great. I'm so glad to learn more about humiliation studies. I really never thought about it this much, but it really is kind of, it's kind of one of those basic things where you peel back all the buzzwords and you peel back all the trends. And when you're looking at humiliation, that's a real basic thing. And I really thank you both for being on the show and sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Heather.
Join us next week. We're going to be talking about more issues that involve women and men and human beings in this world. And I thank you for listening. And I thank you, Linda. I thank you. I hope you'll come back and join us again, Evelyn and Linda. Like to hear from you again. Thank you for joining us on Three Women, Three Ways.
Some other banks offer you a promotional savings rate, then they drop it just a few months later. Don't fall for it. Open an account with Capital One and get one of the nation's best savings rates that's not a promotional rate. Plus, you can open an account in just 5 minutes online or at a Capital One cafe. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
For consumers only. Offered by Capital One NA, member FDIC. Copyright 2017 Capital One.